So I'm going to make a quick announcement of a meeting on 1,000 years after the supernova 1006. We want to have this meeting to cover core collapse and type 1A as well, since this is a wonderful opportunity for us to celebrate 1,000 years of supernova observations. If you think you can still survive the 1,000 years millennium memory of 1054, then maybe I think most of us cannot last that long. So please go to this webpage and register. So there are some wonderful things. For instance, we actually have a supernova remnant. The remnant of 1006 taken like maybe 1,000 years ago. So if you want to find out what this is, just try to go to the meeting. So I'm going to talk about the perimetry or asymmetry of supernovae. So I will give an overview of what we have learned during the past years about asymmetries of supernova. You know, when we started this work, most people are talking about spherical supernovae, although sometimes they add a little bit of instabilities or hydrodynamic instabilities to the explosion. But the question we want to answer here is, are supernovae globally asymmetric, and how asymmetric they are? So, from physics, let's start from some basic physics. We know that stars are not completely spherical, and they may have companions, and they all rotate. And core collapse supernovae usually they involve, they produce neutron stars or black holes that may be rapidly rotating. That means some kind of symmetry axis or asymmetry is built into these processes. And we know stars have magnetic fields, and explosions may subject to a lot of instabilities. So the question now is, how can we measure the asymmetry? This is not easy. For the very nearby supernovae, we can take images and study study the symmetry by looking at the ejector. So this may be for the supernova 1987A, or maybe we can see, CAS A is not spherical. May have a jet even. So, and also for some more distant supernovae, or the supernovae cannot resolve, sometimes we can see, take spectra and see if the spectral profiles are consistent with spherically symmetric ejector. This is not always the case. Actually, in many of the best observed, in the two best observed supernovae, we find that they are usually we can see the signatures of asymmetry from spectroscopy. And of course, we know that hypernovae show spectroscopic signatures of asymmetry, rather big global asymmetries. We can see that by comparing the line profiles from different chemical species, and then maybe even try to fit in a detail of the line profile. And then we can try to invert the profile and try to deduce the ejector structure. And of course, the most direct, most powerful probe for asymmetry is spectropolarimetry. So how does spectropolarimetry work? So the physics here is very, very simple, although it can get, if you do it right, it can get to a degree that is very, very complicated and very hard to handle. Let's start with the basics. Then basically the position is produced by electron scattering. We know Thomson scattering, each of the scatter create a photon with a preferred direction. The direction in the electromagnetic field oscillate will remember. It has a memory of where it goes in of the scattering plane. And of course, there are also line scattering. lines also scatter. So you have an atomic line, and you excite an electron, excite an atom, and that atom, if the decay of that level is fast, then it remembers how it was excited. So that atomic level, when it re-emits a photon, it will remember the initial the direction where the photon excited first, in the first place. And when there is when the explosion is spheric, then all these basically line scattering and electron scattering combine through a very complicated coupled radiative transfer process that gives you the observed polarization. So from the eject point side, so from the structure, we know the structure of a supernova ejector, it may be bipolar. Sometimes people are now talking unipolar. Actually, Adam Burrows has a model which is probably so far the only core collapse model that still claims it can explode. All the other core collapse models seem to have trouble with that. So there is a unipolar model or bipolar structure, or of course there is always clumpiness. So now let's look at how a photon emerges from a supernova ejector. So suppose we have a supernova, and here is a photosphere. So a photon will start moving outward, or start being trying to escape from the photosphere. So it is scattered by electron, by another electron, or sometime maybe by atomic line. But let's think about electron scattering only. So it scatters several times. So this is a random work process, basically. So the photon is just working randomly. And when it emerges, so this photon will, the last scattering plane at last scattering angle determines how that photon will be polarized. When the source is spherical, suppose now the supernova remnant, the supernova ejector is completely spherical, then all these little vectors, these little polarizations, will cancel, because you can add up all this, and then you don't have any direction, you don't have any preference, so it is going to be of zero polarization. But now what happens if you have an elongated or somewhat deformed ejector? So what happens is that the these little vectors, when they add together, you can see there is a preferred direction. There is a major axis somewhere and a minor axis somewhere. So this is where you can detect a net polarization. So that's for electrons scattering. But what happens if now you have a clumpy chemical structure here? So there is, there is an opacity here. Let's first assume it's a line, it's a continuum opacity. Maybe there are some more nickels here, so it is more highly ionized here. So what it happens is that the opacity here is changed. So does the vectors, the weighting to these vectors in this area. So what you do when you sum all these things, you will have a deficit here in this area. That also produces a polarization. But if that is if it's a continuum, then you will see this effect across the spectrum. But if it's a line opacity, suppose it's just H alpha line, so it's a pure H alpha clump here, and it's H alpha, then you're going to see this effect only on the H alpha line. So this is where you're going to see a polarized signature across the H alpha line, across a certain absorption lines. So I was saying that in polarization, basically you add up the polarized flux. The polarized flux is the degree of polarization multiplied by the flux from a certain area. So the total polarized flux is basically summing up all these little polarized fluxes. And that's for the case when you have a global structure. So, but also, it's still another kind of random work here, is that, so now you have a lot of clumps. So I have not only one clump, but a lot of clumps, and each of these little clumps produce some kind of polarized flux. And if I sum all these up, so if I have infinite number of these clumps, then the sum, of course, will be zero. The total vector will be zero. But if you sum these vectors, you know, if you have, excuse me, it will not be zero. So this is, if you sum all these little vectors, it's a pure random work process. It's just like adding these vectors together. So we know random work, it is basically given by the total length you work. With n steps of this step size, it's just square root of n multiplied by the step size. So you still work some distance. So this is the net position if you have a situation like this. But your net polarized flux. But your degree of polarization has to be divided by the total flux. Actually, if you do this, in the end, you will find that the degree of polarization is going to be like inversely proportional to the square root of the number of lumps. So this is just some simple model. I'm giving this here just to let you have a feeling that this, what I'm talking here, are based on very, very simple physics. So you can do an exercise. Suppose at a certain epoch, then now these vectors disappear. So some clumps somehow moved outside the photosphere, so they are not effective anymore. You can see your position will change from this to that. So there is a slight change of degree of position angle, but also maybe the change of the strength of position. So it's unlikely to be a dramatic change, because your random work, if you remove a few steps, you can still, it's just some small change. So this is, there are some stability in doing a random work kind of calculation. So now, what are the observational consequences? So suppose you have such a smooth structure, like the first described as, in such a structure, suppose all the positions are due to electron scattering, what you find is that if you take measure the position in different colors, that means different wavelengths. So suppose you measure position in UBVRI in different wavelengths, what you find, and you plot that on your KOU diagram, so the degree of position will be different in different filter, because maybe some, you know, the opacity efficiency of scattering may be different. So if you plot on KOU diagram, you're going to see, plot this, so they are going to form a straight line. So why they form a straight line here is, again, think about it this way, because there is just one single symmetry axis for this ejector. If there is one single symmetry axis, so basically this QU vector measures just departure from spherical symmetry. There is just one direction it is departing from spherical symmetry. That's why it is going to be a rather good straight line if you observe the position in different colors, different wavelengths. But now let's distort this picture a little bit more. So now you make it lumpy. You add clumps to this. So then you measure in different colors. Then they are not going to be on a straight line, and it is perturbed. There is going to be a major axis, but now the lumps are going to be scattering around a major straight line, a major axis. So we call this a dominant axis. So usually when you observe something, if it has an elongating, I mean, you try to deduce the direction which there is a preferred direction. That's probably where the major asymmetry, major axis of the symmetry lies. And also, you want to test if all the data are consistent with being on a single straight line. If they are, it's this case. If they aren't, then you prove there are lumps in the ejector. And these are very important. So this is the way, you can see we have a very simple, straightforward way to probe if the ejector is lumpy. So now, talking about a symmetry in supernova, we have to mention ADSM-A. So this is the paper, this is the data taken by the SINCE team, which Dick and I are both a member of the SINCE team. So you can see this is the supernova ejector. So we have started this, and the interesting thing here is that the elongation of this ejector is roughly consistent with the very early polarization measurement. And so in the early time, there were polarization measurement which shows a symmetry axis like lying in this dashed line. And then you measure this, you can see this is a confirmation of earlier polarization measurement that although they are measuring very different layers. So earlier polarization measurement is not measuring this little area. It is measuring the geometry that is on the of the ejector, not the ring, at a larger, much further out. That is a very massive hadron layer. So the very massive hadron layer has the same symmetry axis as the very inside oxygen-rich layer. So this oxygen-rich layer is moving at the velocity of probably less than 2,000 kilometers, most of this 2,000 kilometers per second, whereas the hadron feature that was measured earlier, that was moving at about five times the velocity of the oxygen. So you can see globally that the ejector has a symmetry axis from very further out in the hydrogen layer all the way down to the oxygen-rich layer. And the axis is remarkably similar in direction. And now, if you look at the circumstellar ring, then you see again the axis, the symmetry axis of the circumstellar ring is also quite consistent with the ejector, symmetry axis of the ejector. So I think this is a very strong evidence that core collapse supernova, somehow angular momentum must play a role in core collapse supernova. Somehow, so the same symmetry axis or the same angular momentum has been playing a rather important role from the mass loss rate, mass loss during the very early progenitor phase, all the way to the seconds when the supernova explode. Of course, this Rob will talk about this. So in terms of polarization, we have measured much more, but I give some examples here. This picture shows two supernova. One is 93J, very bright supernova, and another 96AB. You can see we observed this supernova with two different telescopes. And it was two different supernovae. One was observed at KPNO. There was observed at a McDonald 2.1 meter telescope. The remarkable thing is that the polarization spectra of these two are very, very similar. So that shows that we have the capacity now, even at a 2 meter telescope, to do some serious polarization measurement. So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail with this, but I'm going to show some data which I think illustrate the point I was making when I was giving the introduction of how polarization was created. So this is a plateau phase core collapse supernova. A supernova is a very massive hadron envelope. What you can see, the data can be very well fitted by a straight line. And if you calculate chi-square per degree of freedom, the departure from this, it is consistent with absolutely everything is on a straight single line. So this supernova, for this plateau phase supernova, we find a symmetry axis. Well, the explosion appears to be asymmetric, and it doesn't appear to have very much of an instability, at least for this supernova. And we have a type 2N supernova as well. So this is a supernova showing very strong interactions. So this is data of two apex, Q and a U. This is Stokes on the Stokes plane, Stokes Q and a U plane. I'm sorry for the quality of this picture. But so basically, the data again is showing very remarkable elongated structures, which is we call a dominant axis. So there is a dominant axis of the symmetry. And this one is actually, again, quite consistent with being a structure with very little instability. So now we have a type 1c supernova here. So this is a supernova that sometimes people think are associated with GRBs. And this supernova, you can see, we have, this is time axis, this is degree of perturbation, sorry about this quality. So you can see the time evolution of the perturbation, and you can see the spectral features of a perturbation, and this one is polarized by more than 4%. To polarize more than 4%, you need a symmetry axis about 3 to 1. So this one is highly elongated ejector. So this is a supernova that sometimes some people call hypernoid. So this is another hypernoid. This one, it's very, very noisy because we were observing a very faint star on a 2-meter telescope. And this one, you can see the perturbation here on the Q and the U vector. So now you can see what I mean by instabilities or structures in addition to the dominant axis. You can see an elongation here. The different colors gives different wavelengths. So you can see an elongation here. But you can see also obvious scatters. So this is not going, this a straight line does not fit this data cluster well. And actually, so this indicates there are more structures than a simple elongated structure. And this is supernova 2003 DH, of course. So this is a work by Subaru telescope. And we actually have a perturbation of this as well. So I'm comparing this perturbation with that, with the hypernova there, the 2002 AP. So this was published in a paper, Kawabata et al. And you can see, well, the data are very, of not great quality, but you can see maybe the perturbation is rather similar, but a lot of instabilities there. So I think I'm going to skip some. Why it's going backwards? Okay, sorry. So I'm going to say a few words about type 1A supernova. Type 1A, on the other hand, is very, very different. It shows a lot of this. So this data cluster for type 1A, it doesn't consist. It's not consistent with a dominant axis or principal. There is still a principal axis, but the major feature there is very large dispersions across the major axis. That implies a lot of instabilities going on in type 1A supernova. So, and you can see we, our data, yeah, this is some more QU diagram for type 1A supernova. Here I give also chi-square per degree of freedom for these features. So you can see for this, many of these measurements, except this one is consistent with say. So we can actually probe the chemical structure and lumpiness of different chemical layers. So magnesium here is obviously not that lumpy, but the silicon 2 and oxygen 1 appears to be rather lumpy. So I'm going to skip this because I don't have time. They are beautiful pictures though. So here, actually I want to make a point here. So we have this, so about type 1A supernova. So we were talking about, most of the time we think that we have problems with extinction. That's as the major uncertainty for using type 1A supernova for cosmology. So basically the R sub B value we deduce, the extinction coefficient for R, for extinction correction we find are usually much too small. From cosmology field are usually much too small than the canonical galactic value. So here the idea is that maybe some of this extinction was caused by circumstellar dust. If that is the case, actually it will fit rather well by if you take into account the fact that circumstellar dust can also scatter photons to your line of sight. Not only scatters away, but also it scatters in which is a major difference from the interstellar dust. You can calculate different extinction curves based on the same model, and you will find that there are some circumstellar dust actually fit pretty well to some supernova. For instance, this one, if you say, so this is a model supernova, template supernovae. So you apply extinction to this supernovae. So this is the color curves. These are light curves. So apply extinction to match the observed color of some supernova, a highly extinguished supernovae. And you do that, if you apply the interstellar extinction, what you find is that the supernova is way too faint to fit the observation. Fainter by 2 magnitudes. That is a huge error. Hugely wrong, let's say. So if you do a circumstellar dust calculation, then your extinction curve fit, you see, in different colors, they fit well. And this red line is a circumstellar dust extinct template. So this the black and red are just, one is just a supernova runs through a circumstellar dust. And you can see they fit rather well. So circumstellar dust fit quite good for some supernova at least. And you can try to calculate the R sub B, well, some extinction coefficient. Actually, you will find there are some spikes. So here I put it in two cases. Case A, the interstellar. So this is the canonic value for interstellar dust. And now this is the usually, if you run through a circumstellar dust calculation, you get a extinction coefficient like this. So basically, they appear to be split into two beings. So I want to make a final remark on quark-clap supernova. I'm not going to go back to type 1a. So what is the most important question for quark-clap supernova? Not for GRB, but for quark-clap supernova. I think the critical question is, so does every quark-clap supernova, well, how frequent a type 1a supernova harbor a jet? So this is an observational question, basically. So how can we probe this? Is there a way that we can probe the jet in a type 1, in a normal quark-clap supernova? So maybe some, you may think, well, maybe like GRBs, that maybe you can probe if there are high energy neutrinos that are muons or something. Or other, you can say sometime maybe there will be gamma ray bursts if the jet emerge from the from the stellar surface. If they don't emerge, then you probably will see the neutrino burst, you're not going to see the gamma ray burst. But these are very hard to detect. But maybe in the future with S-cube, there are papers showing that this can be seen to a redshift property 0.02 or some 0.03, which might be possible. So then, I mean, the other thing is try to study the highly asymmetric chemical structure. So how to do this? So here is the idea. So maybe what you can do is to have you must discover a supernova, a quark-clap supernova, seconds after explosion. You must catch up the phase when the shock breaks out from the surface of the star. And the star will be so bright and that for that few seconds or minutes that you can actually map the light propagation. When the shock emerges, you're not going to see the whole star all at once. You're going to see it step by step as the light travels through the star. So there is a light travel effect here, which lasts about from minutes to about half an hour or an hour. And that is, at that time, the supernova is very, very bright. And when the shock emerges spherically, it gives different light curves. So all you need is to have an array of telescope, maybe monitoring some nearby clusters like Virgo clusters or COMA, so that you find all those, you find some flash, the shock breakout phase of type 1a supernova. Okay, thank you.
You were saying that for one of the type 1c supernovae that you've looked at, that you have evidence for 4% polarization, and you said that implies a symmetry ratio of 3:1. Can you explain how do you convert the polarization to symmetry axis ratios?
Yeah. So you know, polarization is very difficult. It's very difficult to generate polarization. So suppose you have a disk, edge on a very thin disk. The maximum you can get is about 10-11%. So to have 4% polarization is very, very difficult. You can to get the true value of the geometry, you need to run through some relative transfer calculations. Peter Hofrich has done 3D, Monte Carlo calculation of polarization, and that number is based on that.
Yes, I was very interested in your random walk idea, and I was wondering, I mean, if you actually had scatter occurring in a turbulent medium, you wouldn't expect a sort of root n random walk, you'd expect a Levy flight, and so I was wondering if you could actually tell the difference in the data, so when you had that scatter on your asymmetric plots, whether you could distinguish, you know, n to the minus half scatter to n to the minus one over mu, where mu is not 2. Do you make that doable?
I don't understand.
If you think about scatter in turbulence, so your clumping, this is due to turbulence now.
Yes.
You wouldn't get n to the minus a half. You'd get n to the minus something else. Mm-hmm. And that would tell you something about the evolution of the turbulence.
Yeah, exactly.
Whether you could measure that.
I didn't get into that. I mean, that thing I think those theories, theoretical, hydrodynamic, people doing hydrodynamic calculations should be able to predict how this should behave.
Yeah.
So I give it as a simplest example. Yeah, of course. Yeah, you're right.
Interesting to measure it.
Yeah.
I could not understand it, if the polarization, I guess, is a result of Compton scattering of free electrons, because the atomic emission is not polarized. So how can you predict translate the observed polarization without knowing what is the fraction which is actually scattered or emitted, without dividing between two emission mechanisms from the surface of the sun, of the star?
Yeah. So the physics here is that most of this supernova feature were produced by the so-called P-Cygni resonance scattering. So that create P-Cygni profiles. So that's basically a continuum photon when it interact with a atomic level. The model we are using now, I'm not sure which one is right. So there are actually two models. One is that when you scatter, then you lose all the memories. So you don't. The photon that comes out from the atomic level, the atomic scattering will be unpolarized. But for some maybe optically thin lines, so this may not be the case. So you will scatter, and it is just like more or less similar to electron scattering. It will still remember a direction, so that still generates some correlation. So, So this is the two scenarios. We cannot distinguish. I asked a theorist. They couldn't tell me which one is, because the two will talk. As if they see, depend who you talk to, they are always right.
I was wondering if you were monitoring a certain supernova, the 1C or the hypernova you mentioned, over time, and whether you saw polarization changing as a function of time. Because as you know, for the supernova ejected, the photosphere recedes as a function of time. And so at later times, you can see into deeper layers. And whether you saw perhaps an increase of polarization as you went closer, or whether it stayed the same.
Yeah. So the polarization, so in general, polarization of core collapse supernova is about a few times larger than the polarization of some type 1A supernovae. The behavior for the core collapse supernova is that as time goes on, the polarization does increase. And another rather rough statistics, is that the degree of polarization also increases with decreasing envelope mass. So if you have like a type 2 plateau with 10 solar mass of hydrogen, then it's going, the polarization is very low. But if you have no hydrogen at all, then the polarization is very large. That is the type 1c case. So that's the 97x.
Well, I think I have a comment about this recent paper by the Berkeley group that followed a type 2p in polarization, and they see a sudden increase as the supernova falls off the plateau, as if there is a symmetry deeper in the sort of 1b, or you would observe as a 1b, and then this drops again. So that's a nice thing. Vikram.
I think we can tell there is an ambiguity here. So circumstellar dust can scatter the light from the supernova, and if it's asymmetric, it will create polarization as well, even if the supernova is perfectly spherical. Okay, but there is a way to test this. So if the dust is scattering, then you have a pattern that the degree of polarization will increase. The longer you wait, the higher the polarization, because the more the scatter the contribution to your light. Well, if you have a confined circumstellar environment, I agree, maybe you can construct the the circumstellar dust kind of distribution that can do some of this. But I mean, I'm not sure if you will be able to produce all the spectral features, polarize the spectral features.
So even though I guess this is not a conference on 1As, your talk made me think a little bit. So there are two models for 1As. One which is basically a star which becomes massive enough it starts exploding. And it seems to me in that model, it's more natural that the explosion starts inside out. Whereas if you have a coalescence, it's not impossible to think, or more likely, that it'll be outside in. And there's a huge degree of asymmetry between these two models. So does the kind of low polarization favor one model or the other? What is the sort of?
So we have a paper submitted, but we got a reference report, but I haven't replied. But I can make a comment here, is that so basically, we favor a model that that there are significant amount of asymmetry outside. So we don't know how that was generated, but it appears that the degree of polarization really reduced to basically nothing at the center.